Design Classic with Michael Bogle.
Okay, it's time for our Design Classic segment with our design historian, Michael Bogle. Good evening, Michael.
Yeah, hello, how are you?
Hello, and you are listening to the right device. We're talking about television on the radio tonight.
Why?
Well, you tell us. You came up with television. Why did you? Well, television obviously has been one of those items, especially for my generation. I don't remember a time when there was not a television in my home. It's just always been there. But it wasn't always the case. So you want to take us back to those the history of television, the history of the moving picture. When did it all start?
Well, TV has a complicated history. There's a history we want to remember, and then there's some bits that we'd really like to forget. But it all begins with a sort of projector show with light rays concentrated through a series of still images that rotate or move in a kind of time lapse. This projects what seems to be moving pictures, but of course they aren't really. So our eyes are telling us that that's so. Remember the flash books that we made as children?
Oh, yeah, with the little stick men and you flip them really quickly. Yeah,
that's right. And you think, oh, well, they're moving right along. That's exactly the same thing.
Well, a lot of television that's on at the moment isn't much better than those little flick books, is it?
we can sure you give us some competition, that's a fact.
Let's put that to air, Flickbook, and see how it rates, Michael.
That's right. I don't know how it's going to work on the radio, though. That's
no, on the radio, one. Yeah. That's tricky. Well,
some of these early devices used a kind of film reel housed in a cabinet where the reels were turned by the viewer. It says a crank on the side. And you peer at them through this viewer, which is like the inside of an old-fashioned snorkel mask. You do when you do skin diving?
Yeah, really?
Yeah, you put your face right down on it. And these booths are often, they're held in a shuttered booth. This cabinet's a kind of ancient ancestor of the first TV.
Oh, right. And you put a little curtain over the back of your head, one of those.
That's right. Ah. Or inside the curtain booth itself so that people couldn't see you having a look.
Yeah, right. So that's where it started. And then, of course, there were these peep shows.
Yeah, that's it. Penny a peep.
Penny a peep. That's cheap.
Well, by today's standards, pretty cheap. You could get five peeps for 5 cents.
Well, I charge a lot more for my peep. I can tell you that, Michael. That's for sure. So we had these penny a peep peep shows, and then someone came up with the bright idea of, taking it to the next stage and transmitting it through the air.
They did. But before that, there was this issue about the peep shows getting a bit of censure because they were originally intended to be educational, but then unfortunately they spun off into lewd peep shows. But I'm sure none of your listeners would be interested in those.
If you remember seeing a lewd peep show, we'd love to hear from you. 1-300-800-222. 1-300-800-222. Did you hear or heard stories, maybe from your folks or your grandfolks, about some of those early lewd peep shows, early stages of television? Okay, Michael, carry on.
They're pretty common at fairs and fetes and festivals. And out in West Australia, West Australians would remember a guy called Kieran Ward. He used to have a column which ran in the Perth newspapers called Peep Show. This is in the late 1940s. The Peep Show still gets used sometimes in discussing politics, where they say, like, a politician is just giving you a little peek at what's the full reality. You just get a little glimpse, but you don't get to see the whole story.
Right. And so this led to the first television. Who came up with this?
Oh, the first TV comes from a German guy. Of course, they're always into something. A guy called Paul Nipkow, Nipkow.
Mm.
It came with a scanning process which used a perforated spinning disc that could scan patterns through these tiny holes, and then the images themselves would show up electrically, and he could send them to an identical disc which could reproduce what the first disc saw. It's rather complicated. But in 1883, he had one working. He called it an electric telescope.
Right. And could you buy one for your own home?
Well, you could buy one, but they didn't really make the commercial reality. But the Germans, in 1936, revived his name for the Olympic Games, which they actually televised. The first Olympic Games to ever be televised, and really one of the first sports to be televised. and they called it the Paul Nipkow Television Berlin.
Wow. And so, you know, was this the big breakthrough that TV was looking for? Did it take off?
Well, yes, it did. I think 1936 was an amazing event, of course, seen all around the world. But the first real breakthrough, from our point of view, came from a Scottish guy called John Baird, who also invented socks for people with cold feet. He's my patron saint, really.
Double sock. That's what I always say, Michael. Double sock.
Double sock. Mm. So I'll remember that tonight. Baird went back to this spinning disc, but he had the advantage now of wireless or radio waves. When Nipkow was first working, he didn't really have radio waves he could use. So by 1920 or so, people were talking about television, the actual word television, and using terms like radio vision or iconoscope. That was another one.
Right, so radio with pictures.
That's it. Radio with pictures were around in the 1920s, but they didn't really move enough to hold people's interest, because now we've got the cinema. You could go to the cinema and see a newsreel.
Right. And so where could you see one of these John Baird machines?
Well, in London in 1925, they put one up in a department store called Selfridges. And it was sort of a peep show, too, really, because you had to peer through this long tube and see these images moving around in the distance.
Okay, so that wouldn't have been too exciting, would it?
Well, it wasn't exciting, but the fact that it could be transmitted by radio waves was very, very exciting.
And what was the actual picture quality like, though, Michael?
It's quite poor. It was divided vertically, so you got this kind of flickering image. I'm trying to think of what it looks like. It looks like a series of slightly out-of-focus pictures with vertical lines in it, because there was a sort of screen or scan that came across. You wouldn't find it very interesting, but people were fascinated by the fact that it moved and it could be sent from one place to the other remotely. That was the staggering thing.
We're talking televisions with our design historian, Michael Bogle, tonight. If you have an early television memory, do you remember the first thing you ever saw on that first television set when you were a kid? Let us know. Give us a call, 1-300-800-222. We would love to hear your memories about some of those very large televisions, actually, with some of those early models, weren't they, Michael?
Yeah, huge, man. Barn size.
Yeah, barn size. So when all of this was going on in London, what was going on here in Australia in terms of television?
Well, people were talking about television. We actually had an early demonstration of this TV in Melbourne. We had one, let's see, when it was 1929-30. They showed one in Melbourne and they later showed one in Brisbane. This kind of whirling disc that Baird had invented. But it was really, because the pictures were interesting, but it was a very ugly device, had no cosmetic housing or covering over it at all. When he was demonstrating this crazy disc in London, he put one on for the Royal Institute, and everyone came and had a look, and one visitor was having his likeness made through this television, and he sat too close to one of Baird's discs, which was whirling around, and it caught his beard.
Oops.
People that time had it. Yeah, that's exactly right. And pulled out, according to the news reports, quite a sizable tuft.
Was yanked out of his beard
by
the device.
Exactly right. Yeah, early version of a hair removal device, I guess you could say.
Well, it's a good way of, you know, saving time, killing two birds with one stone. Imagine if your television could shave you now.
Well, something. Oh, no. This is getting frightening now.
This is when you to switch the lamps off we were talking about last week.
That's right, the dark shadows.
In the dark
room.
Shadows. You find a dark shadow and get up to it there.
The television shaves you.
Okay, so you've got to be careful because it's obviously a bit of a dangerous device. But we don't get television here in Australia till what, 1956?
1956 or so. But by the time we get the TV here, it's come quite a long way, really. What we've come up with is a cathode ray tube, which could use an electronic spray of pictures and transmit them to a receiver, which then showed it on a fluorescent screen. This got a patent in 1923. But about the same time that Baird was poking around with his. But when this cathode ray tube appeared, it's really the end of this whirling disc thing altogether. just wasn't going to work. Too many moving parts.
Wasn't going to survive, okay? So yeah, the cathode ray tube took over, and that became roughly the model we had for many decades after that.
That's right. But the curious thing about these early TVs, including this Baird television, is the screens were round, and they were actually quite small. They wouldn't be much bigger than, like a saucer.
Okay.
Like a small saucer, and the screen was round, so the resolution in the lens wasn't very good.
Very fuzzy.
Very fuzzy, and this strange kind of vertical line that you got.
Okay, and so I remember, so the televisions arrived. Do you remember the first, we all, you know, have heard the story of Bruce Gyngell and, you know, this is television and things, but, how many people were tuning in? How many televisions were around broadcast actually happened? Was it still quite a novelty?
I can't answer that question. It'd be really good, interesting to know, really, but I have to say that the TVs that came out were very, very expensive. When TVs went on sale in New York in 1939, they showed them at the World's Fair. 120-millimeter telepicture machine cost $200. That's a lot of money. But you could get a big screen. This is 120 by 250 millimeters. That's not very big either, for $1,000.
Wow, that would have been more than a house.
That's right. Would you rather have a house or a television?
I'd like to have both, actually.
What a decision to have to make.
Yeah. Well, that's probably why they were so big. You could live in your television because you couldn't actually afford a house.
Well, you know, I think that some people actually do live inside their TV right now.
That's true.
In terms of the programming, you know, what are we watching tonight? What are we watching tomorrow?
Yes, it can be hard to switch off once you've switched on. Okay, Michael, so we know they're pricey, but 1956 they come to Australia. Why has it taken so long to get to us? Because the BBC has been broadcasting since very early on.
Well, like everything in Australia, in that particular period requires a huge capital investment. And not many people had the capital they wanted to invest in. It generally takes the government to push it on. Like they hold a motor car, for example, it would never have happened without a big Commonwealth loan guarantee and so on and so forth. And the railways, for example, always paid for by the government, whereas in the United States, they're run by private enterprise. So we have to have someone just set up these big networks. The government's quite reluctant to do that. And so there's a bit of a fight about who's going to pay, really. That boils down to that. And then people were nervous. They were terrified of television. One guy writes into the Argus in Victoria in 1953. He says, "It's our right to demand TV, and on its introduction, we shouldn't have the unsavory features of American TV," whatever that might be.
Mm. And there were also fears that it would replace radio.
Exactly. People thought that the radio waves would be interfered with by the television waves and make all their receivers obsolete. So there was a huge amount of resistance to that, too. And, of course, we have to have a Royal Commission.
Of course, we have to have a Royal Commission. And, of course, none of those things happened. And it went ahead and we got those first television stations, 9, 7 and Channel 2.
Yeah.
And what about those early shows? Now, of course, some of our listeners are going to remember some of these. The Bobby Lim Late Show, that was so famous in one of the early broadcasts.
Yeah.
The yacht races, the tennis, there was lots of sport. And The Adventures of Long John Silver, 1958. I remember watching, even when in the 70s, I remember watching the replays of that.
Long John Silver?
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Terrific black and white series. Loved it.
Mm.
So, hey, there'll be people will have memories of those early shows in those early 1950s. Give us a call, 1-300-800-222. What are some of the early shows you remember watching on your early television? What are some of the memories you have? So, Michael, we've got now the television's arriving, it's being broadcast, but how are we using it to promote and advertise? How is it being used for that?
Well, of course, that's one of the things that attract all these commercial networks. They say, well, good Lord, this is like an electronic newspaper. We can sell advertising. Then people get interested and they realize that there's a good deal of money to be made. But first they've got to get a lot of TVs in homes. And so they start doing promotions in stores and even on radio through window displays and Myers and so on. But I have to say that in a BGE television with a screen 430 by 530, by this time they're square, costs 207 guineas, or that translated to today's money, that's $6,900.
Gosh, they're expensive things, aren't they?
1957, you have to pay, by today's money, $6,900.
And they were still really bulky, weren't they? When did they start getting more portable?
Well, they start shrinking them about the same time, strangely enough, that radio does, because they start doing these injected moldy cabinets and so on and shrink them down. And also there's a question of the tube, the shrinking that tube to get it down to the size where the resolution is still quite good. AWA is a real leader in this respect. They use a lot of Australia's finest industrial designers. In 1969, we've got these wonderful orange plastic televisions.
I think I remember one of those. Very cool. Very Space 1999.
That's right. And the handle on top.
Yeah, the handle on top. Yeah, that's right. And the other thing that happened, Michael, as well, is that because we were now designing our spaces for our televisions, they had an impact on our interior design of our homes.
Shook things up terribly. There were all kinds of articles in the women's magazine in particular about what to do with your television, with little diagrams showing how you might arrange the decor in your room, where you could put the TV, where you could put the sofa, so for optimum viewing, descriptions of how to darken the room, you know, so you didn't get glare on the screen of the TV. It's all quite complicated, really. But, I mean, truly it wasn't, but people were nervous about it.
And, I mean, I have to attest to this. Bigger is never big enough when it comes to a television, is it, Michael?
That's right. Yes, that's right. Big. You want one about the size of a billboard now. Yeah. That's what's happened now.
I mean, that's really changed the way we design our spaces. Like the whole one wall of the lounge room or a living room has to be the size to take a big television now.
Absolutely. About the size of a garage door. But I have to say that interior designers and interior architects are horrified by the sort of radical position of TVs in a room, because it leaves this, when it's not running, you get this big black rectangular space on the wall. And it's, when it's not running, it's just a piece of glass reflecting absolutely nothing.
Well, have you seen those televisions that become mirrors?
Isn't that a great... Yeah, I reckon that's the best idea.
Or pictures, you know, so it becomes another painting or something.
Oh, I haven't seen the painting. Yeah. But it's with a nice frame around it, and I think that could be terrific.
So, you know, and what about today? Where is it going to go? Where's the space race going to take televisions?
Oh, God, well, bigger is going to be better, I reckon. But one of the things that's being developed by Sony and other Asian manufacturers is a flexible screen. That means that you could bend it or apply it to a three-dimensional surface, where TVs are usually, except for those big curved ones, just a two-dimensional flat space. But now you could actually take it around a column or around a curve in the room, or you can put it in your wallet, fold it up. Maybe, for example, you could even have a folding screen that you took in your backpack.
Yeah, and the Dick Tracy watch, did that television watch, that sort of never really took off, did it? I mean, people have tried it, but... You know, we've never really taken to carrying a television screen around with us other than, you know, the size of our phone.
Well, I'm sorry, but Apple's already there.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, they've got this massive, well, it's not a massive watch, but a reasonably sized watch, very smart. They can look like a watch or look like a YouTube video or look like a,
but
well,
it's still
like anything.
Oh, right, but it's still small, though, isn't it? No.
Well, it's about Dick Tracy's size.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's still small. Really a big thing. But yeah,
no, it's not big.
There you go. So where do you think, you know, televisions will go from here?
I think, I'm sorry to say, but I think the only thing left, considering people's willingness to share, is a TV implant. Zuckerberg's dream.
That's true, actually. I have seen that in a few science fiction films and television shows. Yeah, we become our own television.
That's right. Push a button on your temple, and you can see everything.
There you go. Like I can turn you on and you can turn me on, Michael.
Or off.
Or off.
Or turn you down. That's
another thing. I think your mother, your wife will be happy with that one.
Yeah, but there is a, there is this Google Glass, of course, and that's being refined again. When that first came out, people were quite annoyed. There were fights in bars and stuff about people wearing Google Glass because they said, "What are you looking at?" And so there would be a, when in San Francisco there were a couple of punch-ups because people were offended by the fact that people were wearing these glasses, which were observing them. And they reached out.
Well, if you've got a favourite television from the years that you remember, maybe that you still have, we'd love to hear from you. 1-300-800-222, 1-300-800-222. Join us and share those memories, the shows you enjoyed watching, when it moved from black and white to colour and how that changed the experience as well. Love to hear from you. 1-300-800-222. Michael, thank you so much for joining us on our Design Classic feature on Nightlife.
Always great fun.
You're taking a bit of a break for a while, but hopefully we'll see you really soon.
Coming back soon.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Okay, good.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.